How embarrassing was that for us?
Oh my God, was it embarrassing?
Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, Garrett Sparks. UNLV is on the road tomorrow playing a game
that they never lose. Never lose this type of game. Plus, the Raiders, maybe they'll try to find the next Ryan Tannehill in free agency. But we start with a 5-2 loss to the last place LA Kings. First off, the Golden Knights fan base is finally an elite fan base. Fan base has been pretty good. You know, you pick up a whole new sport, you dive headfirst into it, you sell out every game, buy way too much merchandise, way too much. But it's been a good fan base. But last night, fan base reached a new level because the Golden Knights were booed off the ice at T-Mobile Arena. After the first period, when they trailed 4-0, and then a little softer booing at the end of the game when they lost 5-2, and that is excellent work from the Golden Knights fan base because booing is the best way to show a collective frustration. Fandom in sports is completely stupid. It's arguably the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life, is to care about sports, to put my emotions and mood in the hands of a sporting event that I have no control over. It's incredibly dumb. It makes no sense whatsoever, but we love it. And because of this, you get to show your frustration when you're frustrated. And losing 4-0 to the last place team in the division? You're supposed to be a Stanley Cup contender. You're supposed to be running away with the Pacific Division, and the last place Kings are obliterating you 4-0 after the first period? Absolutely you should boo. You should have thrown stuff on the ice, too.
I can't believe you're not doing a victory lap.
For what?
For yesterday. You basically predicted that they could lose. Like they.
Yeah, the Kings are good.
The Kings are actually good.
But not really. But they are. But not really.
But you made a fairly like convincing case that like, oh, they should be scoring a ton. Ding. They scored a ton.
Yeah. The best part about fandom is your emotions that you get to do with the way the team plays. And I'll say this about like UNLV fans right now. The best part about UNLV fans right now is that they still have passion for the football and basketball team. It still exists. People aren't really showing up because for, what are we, 6 years now, they haven't been to a bowl game or an NCAA tournament. Like, it's been more than half a decade of ineptness from the athletic department.
I wouldn't even say ineptness. I would say malaise. Like, it was just a, whatever we put out there, they'll show up.
And UNLV fans, so the attendance is down because people are like, all right, you guys suck, so we're not showing up. But people still care. Like, the team has been, the athletic department has pretty much been irrelevant for half a decade. And people still tweet at me that they're mad about UNLV shooting too many three-pointers in a game. People still tweet at me that they don't think Desiree Reed-Francois is a good athletic director. Like, people still care. They still have opinions. They still think, oh, everything sucks. Which is good, because if UNLV ever starts winning again, those people are going to like it. And those people are going to show up, and the fan base is still there. The fan base still exists. Like, Tony Sanchez got booed off the field at one of the games at halftime this year. So it's great because, look, your fans actually care. So I was pumped to hear Golden Knights fans actually boo the team after losing 4-0 to the Kings through one period and not just say, oh, good job, good effort. It was excellent. You should absolutely boo. Anytime your team disappoints you, you should boo.
Yes.
There should be more booing in just everyday life.
I mean, I feel like I would be an unfair recipient of a lot of that booing. So.
Unfair?
Not everything can be my fault.
Bigger problem for the actual Golden Knights. They've got an issue with goaltending. They can't get good production out of their goalie. Since December 1st, which is the last 19 games that they've played, Malcolm Subban and Marc-Andre Fleury rank 41st and 47th in save percentage out of 53 qualifying goalies. 41st and 47th out of 53. It's really bad. They've got both goalies playing well below average. They're both under 900 in save percentage. Fleury is -7 in goals saved above average. Subban is -3. Neither one of those are very good.
One's better than the other.
You've got two goalies playing way below average right now. And last night, Subban gives up 5 goals. And the fifth one didn't matter the most, but that one was the most hilarious one because he gives up a goal right off a faceoff that he just, I don't know, wasn't ready for, or just right off a face-off, shot goes through his legs. Kind of hilarious, actually. But the goalies are not playing very well. Now, despite that, Subban's still been the best goalie on the team for the last 2 months. Now, here's the good news. Goaltending doesn't really matter right now. Like, you need it to be better than it is, but it doesn't really matter right now. I guess they could miss the playoffs if the goaltending stays this bad for the rest of the season. But it's the Pacific. No, it's not going to happen. But goaltending doesn't matter right now. You don't need Marc-Andre Fleury to be a Hall of Fame-level goalie right now. You need him to be a Hall of Fame-level goalie in April, May, and June. And yes, at some point, we will be concerned that he won't be able to do that if he continues at an 8.87 save percentage like he has been for his last like 12 starts. Right, that's very bad. And if that continues, at some point you worry about it. But we saw at the beginning of the year, Marc-Andre Fleury was excellent. Right now, it is a big sample size. It's been 20 games that he's under 900 in save percentage, but it's still, you still have the expectation that Marc-Andre Fleury can play well. And so, to me, I'm not that concerned about the goaltending because I do think it'll come back. I do think that Marc-Andre Fleury will be able to play at a much higher level when they get to the playoffs when they actually need him to. I think Malcolm Subban's going to play at a higher level than he did last night for the majority of his games the rest of the season. Like, that was pretty awful. So I'm not overly worried with the goaltending right now. Give it another month or so, and it's still this bad, then, all right, you start worrying, all right, is Fleury actually going to get back to it when the playoffs come around? Is Subban any good at all? Like, in a month or so, or if it continues like this and they actually do fall out of the playoff race, that conceivably could happen. I don't think it will, but I'm not overly worried at the moment. You see two goalies struggling on the team. Yeah, I think they'll be fine.
Fleury's like Tom Brady this year. He came out the gates, you know, 341 yards, 3 touchdowns. He looked like classic Fleury, classic Tom Brady.
Oh my God.
And then it, you know,
they're going to lose to the Canucks in the first round of the playoffs.
I'm just saying.
Jesus. It's not good. I do want to say one thing, though, because a couple of people tweeted at me about the Golden Knights giving up too many chances, and that's why the goaltending's been poor. In that same time frame, December 1st until now, they are one of the 10 best teams as far as shot and high dangers chances against. Like, they're not giving up hardly anything at 5-on-5. It's the same thing we've talked about for this team for the season long. They take a ton of penalties. They're top 10 in the league in terms of penalty kill time per game, and they give up a ton of chances on the penalty kill. They're top 10 in chances allowed. Like, they give up the 10th most in the league. So the team takes a lot of penalties, and then they're not very good at actually killing them off. So that's really the only thing you can point to as far as, oh, why are the goalies struggling? Let's blame the skaters. That's really the only thing, is they take a lot of penalties and they give up a lot of chances on the penalties. But at 5-on-5, the Golden Knights are excellent. Golden Knights are one of the best teams in the NHL at 5-on-5. So anything that happens at 5-on-5 in this last 20 games for the Golden Knights or so, it's hard to blame that on the skaters, because for the most part, they've been excellent. For the most part, they've been very, very good. Even last night, the Kings only had 4 high danger chances in the first period, which is, you know, you want to give up about 3 per period, so it's a little bit more than you'd like to give up, but it's not like they had 15. It's not like they had some ridiculous amount. They had 4. So it wasn't a great period, but it wasn't like a disaster for the skaters. It was a disaster for Malcolm Subban. And that's how the goaltending has been for kind of a little while now, but I think they'll be fine. I think they'll get it back together. Now, the other issue for the Golden Knights right now is they keep giving up 3 goals to start the game, which is not a good strategy in the sport of hockey to try to win, because they give up 3 goals. Last night it was actually a 4-0 deficit, and then for the final 30 to 40 minutes, they dominate. Last night they're down 4-0 after the first period. In the second period, they outshot the Kings 24-3. That is absurd. To go plus 21 on shots on goal in one period. It's absurd. They dominated that game the rest of the way. Normally, you'd look at that game as a whole. Corsi was 63% in favor of the Golden Knights. Expected goals was 60% in favor of the Golden Knights. You'd look at that game and say, Golden Knights played fine. No, it's just weird they got behind by a lot early. But hockey is a game that's, the way hockey teams play is largely dependent on the score. Across the league, across the years, teams that are leading by more than one goal just shut down. They do not create anything when you're up by more than 2 goals. They stop being aggressive. They play it safe. They play defensive. And the team that's trailing by multiple goals doesn't care about defense anymore. that, like, let's go score. That's all that matters to us. So what it leads to is stats like that. Now, 24-3 is extreme, but any two teams in the NHL that got into the second period and it's 4-0, the same exact game is going to play out right there. So I don't take a whole lot away from the Golden Knights dominating the second and third periods last night, or dominating the second and third periods against the Penguins 2 games ago, because that's just how the NHL plays out when a team gets a 3-goal lead or a 4-goal lead. They stop playing. Happens all the time. It's happened 3 games in a row for the Golden Knights where they are down 3-0 and the other team stops playing. So I don't put a whole lot into this, but I do know what we can blame it on. Big booty mix number 15.
Okay.
Jesse Granger wrote a story for The Athletic about the pregame music in the Golden Knights locker room. Shea Theodore is apparently the designated DJ for the Golden Knights. And his go-to when the Golden Knights have time by themselves as the players before games, his go-to is a hour-long track on SoundCloud called Big Booty Mix number 15.
All right.
So that's the problem. They need to get rid of Big Booty Mix number 15. Maybe go to, like, Big Booty Mix number 7.
I was going to say also, like, what was wrong with 1 through 14?
Oh, you just got to keep coming out with more Big Booty Mix. The people love the Big Booty Mixes.
I am not anti-Big Booty Mix.
Yeah, there's always a need for more Big Booty Mix.
Like, we do a whole show on Sundays at the Westgate that you could call Big Booty Mix. That is not my issue. My issue is... The 15th one was the one that you went,
You got to keep going. Listen, when people love something, you got to keep going back to it.
I'm not...
You sound like you're anti-Big Booty Mix.
I'm not anti-Big Booty Mix.
You're coming off as anti-Big Booty Mix.
All right, well...
We should be anti-Big Booty Mix number 15, though.
Yes.
Because that's the problem. We just got to figure out, is it Big Booty Mix number 7?
I will go to the
Maybe
labs.
Number 2?
We will get samples of all the Big Booty Mixes. And we will do a one-to-one... peer-reviewed study on which Big Booty Mix causes the greatness to swell inside you.
Technically Correct, brought to you by Void Gaming. What am I supposed to do with greatness that swells inside of you?
I was just hoping you'd leave it there.
Go to BeConnectedSports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It is the Be Connected Sports app from Void Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from beconnectedsports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Devin Tillis is a mentor and vocal leader for his high school team.
Devin Tillis is the 7th recruit in TJ Otzelberger's 2020 recruiting class. He's unranked and doesn't have any other significant offers, but we have figured out why TJ Otzelberger wanted Devin Tillis. This is a quote from Tillis to the LA Times. If my energy is up, then I know my teammates' energy is up. If my teammates know that I got their back, they always got my back, and I feel like that's a big key to my game, getting my teammates involved and into the game. Energy! If TJ Otzelberger is recruiting you right now, just talk to him about how much you love diving for loose balls and how much you hate players that don't give maximum effort at all times and how you eat, sleep, and breathe basketball, you will automatically be handed a scholarship. The LA Times wrote this entire story about Devin Tillis and his intangibles.
That's very weird.
Yeah, it's great. Now, his actual on-court game, he is 6'6", and he said this. Coach TJ really talks about his positionless basketball. He sees me as one of those guys who can play 1-4 and really get up and down. The height there, I think, is what sticks out to me, because this is a team. The last game they played, the hardest thing they had to defend was Derek Alston, who's 6'9" and plays on the perimeter for Boise State. UNLV is like, here's 6'4", Jonah Antonio. Like, that's who they're throwing out there to guard him. UNLV's recruiting class right now, Jalen Martinez is 6'10". Reese Brown is 6'9". Devin Tills and Nick Blake are 6'6". They've got a lot of size coming in, and outside of Jalen Martinez, those are guys that play on the perimeter. So they've got a lot of size coming in that could conceivably guard a 6'9 Derek Halston. So I think the size there is what's fun or what could be good for this team, especially defensively, because right now they're pretty small. Like, it's a fairly small backcourt. If you start getting guys that are 6'6" and taller that you can play at the two guard or something, or can handle the ball and even run your offense from time to time, now all of a sudden you are going to have a matchup problem where, oh, they got 2 6'9" guys on the wing. How the hell do we guard that? And you will be able to shut down. Well, I mean, not shut down, but you'll be able to slow down Derek Halston a lot easier. So I like the size.
All right, because definitely didn't have 3 years of excellent size.
Not on the perimeter.
No, that's what I'm saying, is we went from excellent size in the paint to now we're going to have excellent size on the perimeter. And that's going to be... I just am afraid we're still going to be an all-airport team.
All right, that ended much better than I thought. You got lost in the middle of that somewhere, and I was like, where is he going with this? That was a good point.
That didn't feel like a compliment. The Mountain West has signed a new broadcast rights deal.
ESPN is out, Fox is in, CBS is still sticking around. If you remember, the Sports Business Journal reported that the Mountain West was going to dump ESPN and add Fox, and the Mountain West came out and said, that's inaccurate. It is what happened. The only inaccurate part would seem to be the money. Sports Business Journal reported it was going to be $35 million a year for the conference. It's actually $45 million a year for the conference. So the Mountain West got a good chunk of money. We don't have the actual amount each school will get because Hawaii, who in the previous deal was getting $0, is actually going to get a small cut of the television deal, but they didn't say how much. And I think one of the Hawaii reporters even like said it hasn't been finalized yet what cut Hawaii is going to get. But Boise State gets $1.8 million more than the rest of all the other teams. So you give Boise State $1.8 million, you give Hawaii their small cut, and then you split up the rest of it. Ultimately, it should be $3.8, $3.9 million for UNLV. Somewhere in that range for UNLV, which is triple their current amount. They currently get $1.1 million every year from the Mountain West TV deal. So you're getting more than triple that. That is excellent for the Mountain West. That is like probably as good as you could do is say, hey, we're going to triple how much money you're getting from television deals. Now, it's going to be 3.5, where all Power 5 schools are getting $35 million. So you're still very, very far away from those schools, but very good on the Group of 5 level. Now, to nitpick some of the details, good change for the Mountain West. 3 football games and 2 regular season basketball games will be on CBS. The real CBS, the big CBS.
What?
So you might actually watch UNLV play a basketball game on CBS when this new deal kicks in. The football title game could also be on Fox, like the big Fox. So it's good to be on the major networks. That's excellent exposure for the conference and for the teams. But 10 football games and 10 basketball games could end up on CBS All Access, which is a subscription streaming site that CBS offers. So you might have to pay money to a subscription site just to stream a UNLV game in the future.
Why wouldn't you already have CBS All Access? That's where the new Star Trek Picard show is going to be on.
So if you're not Jared, you might have to pay an extra subscription just to watch like one UNLV game next year. I kind of hate that. But ultimately, it's a very similar deal for the consumers. Like, you're just swapping out like ESPNU for FS2. Like, that's what's going to end up happening here. So ultimately, it's going to be the same where you're going to be searching between FS1, FS2, Fox, CBS, CBS Sports Network, or Stadium on Facebook. Like, you're going to be all over the place with the same types of things. So it's not a big change for the consumer side of it, but UNLV gets 3 times as much money to spend, which I think they've already spent by hiring Otzelberger and Arroyo, but at least they got those covered now.
Is there... Are we going to get any student-produced broadcasts?
Of course. Why? What do you think?
Okay.
You think Fox is going to clamor to put Robert Morris and UNLV on TV?
Hey, you're spending the money. You might as well.
Who's spending the money?
You said they are, aren't they?
I mean, Fox is giving the Mountain West money not to put Robert Morris and UNLV on TV, though.
You're telling me that's not better than a rerun of The Masked Singer?
No, no chance.
UNLV football announced 7 new assistant coaches.
No defensive coordinator yet, which is the most important hire that Arroyo is going to make. No offensive coordinator either. Granted, we are expecting Marcus Arroyo to call plays, so the offensive coordinator not quite as important as the defensive coordinator. The pay, though, is the interesting thing here because, for example, they landed Danny Langsdorf to be the quarterback's coach. He was the quarterback's coach at Fresno State last year. He was making $250,000 at Fresno State last year. That matches the highest that any UNLV assistant was being paid last season. And he's now the quarterback's coach. Jordan Pau-Pau was the tight ends coach at Washington. He was making $300,000. He's now the tight ends coach here at UNLV and the special teams coordinator. So if Langsdorf and Pau-Pau got the same exact money they were making at their previous schools, they will be paid more combined than UNLV paid its offensive and defensive coordinators last season. And that's your quarterback's coach and your tight ends coach. You haven't even hired your defensive coordinator yet. So
I'll do it.
If you hire a defensive coordinator and presumably you're going to pay him more than those guys.
No, I'll do it.
You're running out of money in your $2.2 million salary pool. So I'm very curious what they do with defensive coordinator. I'm very curious what these pays actually are. There were two hires yesterday that should help the pay part. Trey Watson is going to coach the cornerbacks, and Damon Magazoo will coach the safeties. They were both grad assistants at their previous jobs. So conceivably, they're not getting a ton of money in their first real assistant coach job. So conceivably, you're saving a little bit of money against the salary pool there. But if they're landing these guys from other schools, getting paid quite a bit for UNLV assistant coaches, I'm curious to see how this pay actually works out when they do bring in an offensive coordinator.
We will run a strict base cover 3, and we will run it very well. I'm willing to take $40,000.
You think you're worth that much? 30. And you just gave away your whole game plan.
Well, no, it's what the Seahawks ran with the Legion of Boom. It's not a complicated scheme. It's more about executing it correctly.
Yeah. When has UNLV had one good defensive back?
Isn't that who he's recruiting?
Yeah, a bunch of 4-star defensive backs that aren't going to end up coming.
That's how you build a team.
The Raiders re-signed Denzel Good.
Backup offensive lineman. He actually made 5 starts this year because the Raiders had some injuries and suspensions.
So swing tackle is a very important position to this team.
He's a solid backup guard. I think the Raiders, I'm expecting the Raiders to go pretty much as status quo as possible on offense next season. Like, I think the only thing they're changing is wide receiver. They're going to throw everyone away besides Hunter Renfrow at wide receiver. Maybe Tyrell Williams, and then it's going to be all new at wide receiver. But you look at the tight ends, Darren Waller, Foster Moreau are going to be back. Josh Jacobs will be back at running back. Probably one of DeAndre Washington and Jalen Richard. Maybe both will be back. Alec Ingold will be back as your fullback. The offensive line is going to be mostly intact, even the backups. And Derek Carr. But that's a good thing because they should focus on the defense. That's where that should be the only thing they care about the offense this offseason, is the defense. I know Derek Carr is the hot topic, but you cannot have the worst defense in the NFL. You cannot spend the second least amount of dollars on your defense next season and expect to actually have a good season. Expect Paul Gunther to do anything with, we spent like $7 on the defense this year. Good luck.
All I want is for them to make NFL history from we exclusively run out of a jumbo set, 6 down linemen plus the tight ends. Derek Carr has one wide receiver. It's Hunter Renfrow. Otherwise, he's handing off the ball, and we have 7 people blocking.
And the Raiders win 9-3.
Yeah, let's bring it back old school. Like 1937 old school.
Coming up, there is reason to believe UNLV's offense is actually going to get much better for the rest of the season. I'll tell you why next.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff on ESPN Las Vegas.
Do you have any confidence UNLV is going to beat Wyoming? It's a bad team on the road.
I have no confidence in any team traveling to Wyoming.
You should. Wyoming is very, very bad. They are 5-12 this season, 0-5 in the Mountain West, and of their 12 losses, only 3 of them are by single digits.
Okay.
It's a blowout. Here's also a fun fact. Wyoming is ranked 300 in KenPom. KenPom, in the KenPom era, I should say, which is 19 years, UNLV has never lost to a team ranked 300 or worse in KenPom.
I mean,
they never lose this game. Yes, it's in Laramie. Yes, they've lost before in Laramie. This Wyoming team is terrible. Like, they are really, really bad. Even the Marvin Menzies first season, that team went 3-0 against KenPom 300 or worse. Like, they don't lose to these bad of teams. Just doesn't happen. As bad as UNLV's been for half a decade, this is not how bad they get. They do not lose at Wyoming. So they shouldn't lose this one.
Are you gonna... I'm waiting for the turn.
Oh, you want the turn?
But if they're...
Here's how they'll lose to Wyoming. Three-point shooting. Neither one of these teams are very good at three-point shooting. UNLV ranks 249th in the country in three-point shooting. Wyoming ranks 259th in the country in three-point shooting. But Wyoming shoots a ton of threes. And Wyoming's defense, the one thing that Wyoming does well, because they don't do many things well, they don't give up a lot of layups. So they do a pretty good job of keeping you from making layups, but in turn, they give up a ton of threes. So Wyoming takes a lot of threes, and Wyoming gives up a lot of threes. What that means is this game simply could be decided by two bad teams shooting threes. So there is a chance that Wyoming has a good shooting game, shoots like 45% from three, and UNLV, like they've done for 7 straight games, shoots 22%. And you lose. So there is a chance it would come down to three-point shooting. Everything outside of that, though, UNLV is significantly better. Like, there's not much reason to think Wyoming could win. I think the only way it happens is if Wyoming shoots a bunch of threes.
If you had to handicap it, what's the likelihood this game just looks like Mario bricks flying?
Oh, very much. Oh, yes. Lots of missed shots. Lots of long rebounds.
A lot of
chances to dive into
the
crowd. Yep, lots of chances to dive into the crowd after a loose ball that was missed off a three.
That actually brings me to the question I was going to ask later, but is the crowd going to be bigger? Is a bad Wyoming team more popular than a middling UNLV team?
No, San Diego State just played there. I think it was Mark Ziegler who covers San Diego State, tweeted out the crowd. There's like 7 people there.
Okay, so it'll be like a home game for UNLV.
Yeah. Now, it is a weekend compared to a weeknight game, so I assume there'll be more people, but it's also January in Wyoming. There could be a blizzard and nobody could get there.
Like, it also...
That's happened before, where Wyoming's played in front of like 6 people, and they're like, oh, it's like -6 out. Nobody can drive. So that's also possible. I don't know what the actual weather is, but it's Wyoming, so that might happen. But no, they do not have any sort of crowd support right now, according to their attendance recently. It's been brutal. Even Boise State, who's decent, they only had like 4,000 against UNLV. Like, they didn't have a good crowd against UNLV. So it's not just UNLV that's down in attendance. It's across all of college sports.
Yeah.
But the Thomas and Mack looks really bad because it's really big. It's really big. Now, here's the strange part about UNLV's season as far as shooting goes, and the reason that I think their offense is going to be a lot better the rest of the season. They started this year shooting pretty well. First 11 games, they made 34% of their threes, which is above average. The national average is 33%. So they were above average for the first 11 games of the season. But over the last 6 games, UNLV has made 25% of their threes. And they've been under 30% in all of those games. So they haven't even had like one good game. They've been bad for 6 straight. 25%, by the way, would be the second worst mark in the country if they had done that for the entire season. So UNLV went from being a decent three-point shooting team to one of the worst in the country over the last 6 games. Now, what do you look to on that? Elijah Mitrulong has missed the last 8 games. He was making 36% of his threes at the time. Elijah Mitrulong, decent shooter. Jonah Antonio, all of a sudden was shooting 35%, comes back from his injury. He's been shooting 22% since coming back. Throw in Amori Hardy, who was hitting at 39% in the first 11 games of the season. He's down at 25% from three over the last six games. Those are your three high-volume three-point shooters. One's hurt. Two of them have fallen off a cliff. Not great. Now, they should come back, though. Take Amori Hardy. He hit 34% of his threes last year. He started this year hitting 39%. I'm pretty confident he's not a 25% three-point shooter. Pretty confident he's a lot closer to 33, 34, 35% from three-point range. Take Jonah Antonio. Excellent shooter at the JUCO level. His one Division I season at Mount St. Mary's, he hit 33%. I feel pretty confident saying he's not a 22% shooter from three, that he's a lot closer to 33, 34, 35%. And then Elijah Mitrelong, who's been in college basketball for 3.5 seasons, and he's shot 33, 38, and 33% from three-point range. He's a solid three-point shooter. Once you get him back, that will help. UNLV's not going to be a great three-point shooting team this year. Like this, they'll have some games, I would guess, where, oh, wait, Donnie Tillman went 3-for-4, or, oh, Nick Blair hit 2. Like, that'll happen, but they're never going to be a great three-point shooting team throughout the season. But they've got enough shooting to not be 25% from three. They should get significantly better, which will make Marvin Menzies, oh, he would ban the threes, which would make TJ Otzelberger's offense look much, much better and make this team look a lot better. And if you combine just average three-point shooting with good defensive play, they're going to win most of their Mountain West games. So they should get a lot better. Now, it's been six straight games of them being terrible, so recent history tells you, yeah, I guess they're going to make all of them. Recent history says, oh, they're not going to be very good, but they should. Like, this should correct itself. They've got much better shooting than 25 freaking percent.
Amori Hardy going, 39 at the beginning and down to,
25% over his last six.
That averages out to, 32, yeah. Which is,
He's right below average for the season. Yeah, like he's had so overall
upticks,
his season's fine.
He'll have his average season.
Yeah, overall his season's fine. But he should come back to a normal level. So should Jonah Antonio. Like, both of those guys right now are not shooting well at all. They've been really bad. So, like, you take Bryce Hamilton, for example. We've never seen Bryce Hamilton be a good three-point shooter. So I don't expect Bryce Hamilton to suddenly start shooting 36% from three. Marvin Coleman doesn't shoot a lot of threes, and we don't really have any evidence that he's a great three-point shooter, so I don't expect Marvin Coleman to start shooting 36% from three. But Antonio and Hardy, and when they get Elijah Mitrelong back, those guys are good. Like, they should be fine.
Can we bring back Jovan Mooring to teach?
Yes, please. I don't care what for. Yes.
No, but just to teach a clinic with Hamilton and Coleman that's called Heat Check.
Yes. Please, you have to get hot before you can heat check. So that would be good news because those players would be hot.
Oh, okay, sorry. The cold heat check.
Yeah, okay. We did that sometimes too.
I bet this will go in. It didn't.
God, I love Jovan Mooring. Bring that guy back.
I just enjoy I could keep dribbling, but I'll just pull up here.
That is no doubt the best part of the Marvin Menzies era, is that they had the worst team in UNLV basketball history, but it gave us Jovan Mooring, and he was awesome. And then his second year, he was also good, and it was like, oh, God, I love that guy so much.
I just absolutely loved the audacity on some of the shots. It's like, there were people open.
No. You want him to pass it to Tyrell Green?
I forgot about Tyrell Green.
What is Jalen Poyser going to do with the ball?
Turn it over.
Yeah. Like, what did you, like, no. There was no better option than, yeah, Joe, just shoot it, Jovan. Like, there's nothing better that offense could have done than just let Jovan Mooring shoot it. I wish he had been on, a good UNLV team. Because he is the guy that, if he was on the UNLV team that, made the NCAA tournament, could have gone for 40 in an NCAA tournament game and would have been, one of the greatest performances ever. Also is the guy that could have gone 1-for-13 in an NCAA tournament game, and you're the reason you're mad that they got beat by a 12 seed. But he could have been the reason that he scored 42 and you went on to the next round.
I just remember a game where he got it past half court and past half court, looks around, he's dribbling, sets, pulls up.
It was open.
And it went in.
It was open.
Just like, that's not a shot. Yep, not a play.
It was open. Better play than any play they would have run, even if it would have worked. It was better. Better chance of getting points. Better points per possession when he just pulls up from half court than anything they could have done. Now, One other thing I want to see the rest of this season for next season, Amari Hardy needs to finish at the rim at a much higher rate. I love Amari Hardy. He has, for the last 2 years, been the best player on the team in terms of, hey, I can get the ball into the paint whenever I want. Last season, he made 61% of his shots at the rim, which is right at the national average. This season, he's at 50%, which is horrific. It's a huge drop-off, 10 percentage points drop-off there. I think some of it is Amari Hardy having to be the bailout guy. He has the fifth most possessions in college basketball in the final 4 seconds of the shot clock. So UNLV, when the offense doesn't work, they give it to Hardy. He's got to make something happen. They do that to him pretty much more than anybody does it to any one player in the entire country. But even with that being said, he's got to be better than 50% at the rim. Like, he's got to get closer to 60%, because we start looking towards the future. We've been saying, hey, year two, you get Jenkins and you get Hardy. That's going to be a great 1-2 punch. Right now, you look at what Hardy's doing at the rim and you're like, he's an inefficient second option. Which, Jenkins comes in, Jenkins is the number one, takes more of the attention from the defense. Yeah, that should help Hardy's efficiency go up. Also, they actually have legitimate spacing and shooting next year around them. That should also help the spacing and him finishing at the rim. But at the same time, 50% is bad. Like, you've got to be finishing higher at 60%. They didn't have great spacing last year, so it's not like he was playing on a great, well-spaced shooting team last season. So we need to see more from Hardy if we're going to project next year that he's going to be a really good number two behind Jenkins. Like, that's something I really want to see, because, again, he gets to the lane. He gets there more than anybody else on this team, and maybe Jenkins is the only one that does it better. I don't know. We'll see how he does in Mountain West play, but he gets to the rim. He gets to the paint very well. His actual finishing there has been very poor. His passing has always been kind of hit and miss. He makes some great passes, but he often forces up some shots when he should be looking to kick out. So his passing's hit or miss, but we really need to see him finishing better. That's the most important thing for him, sort of projecting in the next season.
How much of him winding up with the ball with 4 seconds left is a symptom of Elijah Mitru Long's injury?
Well, he was doing it more earlier in the year.
Okay.
Like, the first 7-8 games of the season is when he was doing it more than he has been recently.
I can't remember which overtime game it was, but to get to overtime, I just remember, like, 3 straight possessions it was. And Elijah just slashes through 3 people and lays it in.
Which one was that? I can't remember. They've played way too many overtime games. What is wrong with this team? They haven't had one in a while, right?
They keep winning
by 15. Ridiculous.
It's going to be 15-15 going into second overtime.
The teams have combined to make 1 of 70 three-pointers.
And Bucket Young has 27 rebounds.
Oh, that's a fun hypothetical. UNLV winning a game hasn't made a three. Do UNLV fans want them to blow the lead in the final minute to get to overtime so they have another chance to make a three?
Yeah. People care about that streak more than, like, there were times during the Menzies era that was, at least the streak's still alive. And it's like, we could have won the game.
Yeah, not important. They're not going to the NCAA tournament. Coming up, can the Raiders find the next Ryan Tannehill?
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Tyler Bischoff is
better with numbers and stuff.
Technically correct.
Math? You're giving me math?
On ESPN Las Vegas.
My headphones broke. This isn't good. Now, the Raiders maybe needed a quarterback. They need to spend all of their effort and energy on the defensive side of the ball, but that's not as much fun to talk about as the quarterback position. Even though Derek Carr is probably going to be back next year, we're still going to spend a lot of time this offseason talking about quarterbacks. Mike Grimala wrote a story in The Sun about quarterback options for the Raiders. He thinks the most realistic option is to sign Marcus Mariota as a free agent and make him Derek Carr's backup / compete for the job. And the way Mike phrased it was that Marcus Mariota, who got replaced by Ryan Tannehill, could be the next Ryan Tannehill.
Okay.
Ryan Tannehill was a mediocre quarterback for the Dolphins. signs with the Titans for $2 million on a one-year deal to be the backup to Marcus Mariota, takes over about halfway through the season, and career year out of nowhere, Ryan Tannehill, like his numbers this year, he's one of the five best quarterbacks in football. He was a mediocre quarterback his entire career. Here's the thing about Ryan Tannehill, Marcus Mariota, and Derek Carr. Their career numbers, you got to throw out this year for Tennessee, but before he got to the Titans, their career numbers are pretty much all the same.
Yeah.
Like, Derek Carr is a little bit safer. He's got a lower interception percentage, higher completion percentage, and a lower yards per attempt, but it's not that big of a difference. They're pretty much the same quarterback across the board. They all have fallen into that, would fall into that range of, all right, he's like the 16th best quarterback in the NFL. Like, they're all sort of in that range for their careers. Now, Tannehill, somehow, I still don't really understand, is one of the best quarterbacks in football. His yards per attempt in his career was like 7.2 or something. It's at 9.5 this year. Like, it's remarkable how much better he got. His completion, his yards per attempt went up by 2 yards. His completion percentage went up by like 7 percentage points. Like, you don't get both of those things to go up usually. Usually you get sort of one or the other, and both of them, he's just, I'm going to have my best year ever in both of them. So Tannehill's been strangely phenomenal this year. So if you could find the next one of those guys, it'd be terrific because he's getting paid $2 million a year. Mike Romala kind of suggests, hey, you could take a shot on Marcus Mariota and hope he is that guy. In general, I think it'd be a bad idea because I think you'd just end up with two Derek Carrs.
Is Andy Dalton going to be available? Then you could have three.
Well, they got Nathan Peterman as their third injured reserve / still on the roster.
They just need to collect every mediocre 18 through like 24 ranked quarterback.
One of them's going to work.
One of them is going, can't be that bad.
So I don't think,
how's Alex Smith's leg?
You could trade for him, right? No, he gets paid a lot of money though. He's got like $20 million. So that's probably not smart. You'd have to get rid of Carr to do that.
He also has an infected leg.
Yeah, that's probably not. Derek Carr's legs still work, so you might not use them, but they work. But on Mariota, I don't think it would be the smartest move because I don't think Marcus Mariota would actually be would actually improve your offense replacing Derek Carr with Mariota. But there are two reasons to think it would be okay. Number one, John Gruden has talked a lot about wanting Derek Carr to use his legs more. Not like to run a zone read, but he just like move out of the pocket and throw the ball down the field, or move out of the pocket and run like for a first down yourself. Marcus Mariota is much more likely to do that. Fun fact, Marcus Mariota averages more yards per carry than Derek Carr averages rushing yards per game in his career. So Marcus Mariota, again, you're not going to come in and run the zone read with Lamar Jackson, but he'll give you a little bit more with his legs, which is something John Gruden keeps on begging for. The other part that would make sense, maybe, is if you could sign him to a really cheap deal. Like Ryan Tannehill, 1 year, $2 million. That's insane. So like if Marcus Mariota, if you could sign him to like a $3 or $4 million a year deal, all right. Like I still don't think he's going to have some breakout year under John Gruden, but there's not much risk. There's not much downside if you sign him to like less than $5 million. Right? So again, I don't know if makes sense is the right phrase, but it'd be okay. It'd be kind of like, all right, we'll see what you can do with Marcus Mariota. Like, he's had some good moments. Like, he's got similar numbers to Derek Carr.
He threw a touchdown to himself.
Yeah, so, like, there's some things you could do there. Maybe he breaks out, but if it's cheap, I could understand. I could get it. We'll see, though. What would they do with Alex Smith? You'd love Alex Smith.
Yes, I do.
But his cap hit is, like, over $20 million, and... Yeah,
no, you'd have to restructure it just like his leg. Is there any other people? Can we get like Ryan Fitzpatrick in there? Like, I'm trying to think of like how many.
Wait, are the Dolphins not committed to Ryan Fitzpatrick?
Josh Rosen, like, just bring. I really want the Raiders to just be like an island of misfit quarterbacks.
Andy Dalton, Cam Newton, Josh Rosen. Who else can they go get? Teddy Bridgewater.
Oh no,
he's probably going to get actual money.
And he's actually will be functional.
Yeah, he's actually going to get money in the offseason. What about which quarterbacks did the Broncos use before Drew Lock? Is Joe Flacco going to be available?
Hey, there you go. Sounds like a Gruden grinder already.
Who did they use between Flacco and Lock? Was it Paxton Lynch? That'll like him. Just keep Deshaun Kizer instead.
Some of y'all football sucks.